Welcome to episode 23 of The Infectious Myth. Now we're finally back to the topic of science, as well as journalism and censorship, with this week's guest, Celia Farber. If you want to comment on any episode, please email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com, or check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, and we're also on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Use the hashtag #TIM. We really appreciate it if you like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or write a review for iTunes. Recommend this show to your friends. Post a link to any episodes that you like on your Twitter, Facebook, or other feeds. Today I'm spending the hour with veteran journalist Celia Farber. She started covering the AIDS story in the 1980s. She strayed a long way from the party line, crossed into heretical territory, and her life was forever changed. Celia is a journalist, author, and editor based in New York City, who grew up in both Sweden and New York City. She's written on a variety of subjects for Spin, Rolling Stone, Esquire, Harper's Salon, New York Press, and more. And she's the author of the book Serious Adverse Events, and also hosts a show on PRN called Radio Free Science, which you can listen to every Friday at 3 p.m. In 2008, Celia Farber won the Semmelweis International Society's Clean Hands Award for Investigative Journalism. Welcome to the show, Celia.
Thank you, David. What a lovely and accurate and generous description. You got everything right except one thing I need to correct, and that is my PRN show. That was my PRN show. My first show was called Radio Free Science. And I left for a while and came back and with a new show. I asked Gary, can I do a show that is a general interest show? And he said, sure. So I came back with a show, which, sorry, this is getting a little confusing. Initially, it was called Time to Talk, and I've since renamed it again. You know how I am. You know how I am about titles. It's called Conversations, and I'm happy with that name of the show. I hope PRN is too. So it's called Conversations.
And is it at Friday at 3 p.m.?
And it is not at Friday. On Friday at 3
p.m.
It's on Thursdays at 8 p.m.
Okay. So apart from the title and the time and the day, we got everything else right.
Exactly. We got PRN right.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, great to be here. Great to talk to you again.
Yes. Well, today we will talk a little bit about the science aspects, but you never pretended to be a scientist. You were a journalist, and so we'll talk about the intersection of science and journalism, especially regarding AIDS. Now, you sent me an essay that you wrote, and I don't know where this essay is posted, but it was called Exiting the Trauma Cult, Reflections on the Emergence of Totalitarian Science. So there's two phrases in there that may confuse people or more need further explanation. The trauma cult. So what is the trauma cult?
Well, first, I'll say that's an essay that I'm going to post it at my website, The Truth Barrier, truthbarrier.com. I actually wrote it, and it came out of an assignment I got from Joan Shenton, our very own and beloved. Joan Shenton is issuing a new, what's the word?
Film.
Can't find words this morning. A new rendition of her book.
Ah, right. I actually interviewed Joan Shenton a couple episodes ago, and we talked about her film and also the reissue of
Reissue, thank you. That was the word I was looking for, of her book. And so she's updating her book, and she asked several of us to, perhaps you as well, to write how did we feel reflecting back on however depressing many years we've been involved in the rather hopeless HIV causation battle. So it started as an essay for Joan, and it grew and grew, and I sat down to think about, you know, what are my conclusions, what are my feelings, and what I came up with was radically different from anything I'd written before, almost like a, without sounding pretentious, but a paradigm shift, where I suddenly realized, wow, I'm on the other side of the canyon, totally. This isn't anything I ever said or thought before. And what I say in this essay is, I don't think we've been in the vicinity or the realm of science, actually I would say, or journalism, I think we've been in a in the energetics of of what's called a traumatic narcissistic cult, and I'm going to quantify all of this. I got really, sometimes I read things and I get really influenced, you know, and it kind of goes, it saturates everything I'm thinking about. And a book I read affected me so much. I read it about 6 months ago. It's called Traumatic Narcissism, Relational Systems of Subjugation by a brilliant writer and psychologist named Daniel Shaw. Mm-hmm. Daniel Shaw was in a cult. He was in a spiritual, you know, a Western version of an Eastern cult, which he doesn't name which cult it was, but it was very clear that, you know, he had the full-on cult experience. He was in it for 10 years and then kind of, you know, ran out of there screaming. And in his descriptions of, in his identification of what he calls, both what he calls traumatic narcissism and what he calls a traumatic narcissist cult, I recognized, you know, just like breathtakingly recognized everything that we've dealt with as we've dealt with this crushing thing, you know, that we've all been trying to counter and answer and make sense of. And I finally realized, oh, this is why we get nowhere. This is why we have failed, quote unquote. This is why there's been no friggin', you know, big debate or yes, let's talk about this or reasonable responses to the obviously stellar questions raised. The reason for all of that is that this thing is not about science. It's not trying to be science. It's abuse. It's an abuse. It's an abuse story. It's a story of domination and abuse. And in domination and abuse systems, they're not trying to understand what the other is saying. It's not trying to not become abuse.
Well, can I actually read something to you that just happened to me today? I was dragged into a conversation by some people who are AIDS drug users themselves and promoters of AIDS drugs and seem to be quite influential and probably are getting money for all their speaking engagements and things like that. And
sure.
One of them made the incredible claim that the newer AIDS drugs have no side effects, and so I posted a number of quotes from papers and from the manufacturer's own literature about serious side effects like rhabdomyolysis, which is basically muscle wasting. And I got this response. It seems to me that you are showing the paranoia associated with the development of HIV-related dementia.
Jesus.
I had three friends die in the 1980s from it. It is a very unpleasant death. I would advise getting a scan. There are more deaths and serious complications from paracetamol for 1,000 taking it from then from all the HIV meds. Of course there are drug interactions between various medications of whatever type. You have no sense of proportion, and your responses are verging on the hysterical. You need help. Like,
wow. See, okay, that's exactly what I mean. Let's hold that up in the light, you know, to the light in our tweezers. That's exactly what I mean. That has in it, it has an abusive proto nature, right? It doesn't allow for the freedom of the experience of the other, the freedom of the choice of the other. It doesn't allow for any dignity of the other.
Right.
That's abuse. And I think we kept saying science, 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 journalism, journalism, freedom, debate, 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 and in a sense missed the elephant. And I feel now that the elephant was, you know, when I say abuse, I feel like it sounds vaporous, but it's a very specific energetic intention to block the what does Daniel Shaw call it? I think hegemony is one of his words, subjectivity. essentially the what have okay, I'll speak for myself. What have I been fighting for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've been fighting for, it's like a space that I've wanted all my life, where you can step into this space and you won't be hurt in that space. You can speak your mind, your heart, your soul. Somebody who has perhaps been HIV positive for 20 years can come into this space and say, I just want to report that this is my experience. I haven't gotten sick, or I have gotten sick and this is what happened, and then have everybody, you know, take that information, take that and respond to it, without violence, without anger,
right,
without, that's the, what I've been fighting for. Just that space, I see it like a circle or like a, you know, like a living room, just a one space,
yeah,
where we're okay, we're not in trouble, we're not going to be hit and hounded and bludgeoned and attacked and degraded and defunded and all this stuff.
Right.
That's
what
I've been fighting for.
I think what distinguishes journalists, other writers from the average person is that they're people who are fascinated by listening, like good journalists, good writers. And what they really want to do is listen to what they consider amazing stories that will disappear into the vapor because they're not written down, and then be able to write them down and share them with other people. I mean, that's what I get out of really good journalism. It's like, oh, this person took the time to go to this place, to listen to this person who was maybe not all that coherent, and put together a short, coherent
like me
summary. Yes. And that's all they want to do,
yeah,
right? They want to have that opportunity.
Right, yes.
And
yes.
What I want to do is, I'm different. I want to take all the pieces of data and put them together and reorganize them until I think I understand the truth behind that data. And that's what I was trying to do on that discussion. And what that guy came back with was, you know, I'm going to say something completely stupid just to show you that I am in charge of this discussion. And you can give me all the data you want about all the side effects of the drugs that are written in the most respectable places, and I'm just going to spit on it, you know, and just mm-hmm. tell you you're stupid. And so he's denying me my space, which is, okay, let's sit down and talk about the data. It's like, no, we're not going to do that. And for you, you want to have a space where you can listen to somebody and not have people yelling and interfering with your listening and being able to write it. I mean, am I right there? I'm putting words in your mouth.
Yeah, not just for me. In other words, let me put it this way. When I am misunderstood, which is most of the time, the way that I am misunderstood is as having been a journalist who advocated against the accuracy of the HIV causes AIDS hypothesis, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I feel I was doing was advocating for the climate of freedom at that intersection between science and journalism, the climate of freedom whereby we are not in trouble for wanting to have this discussion. We are not pathologized.
Right.
We're not in trouble. And in trouble sounds like a kind of a childish term. And that's the piece I think I've taken from my actual childhood. A good friend asked me once, he's Italian, and he, very, very, very interesting mind. He's always looking at people. My friend Ferdinando, he tries to understand why people pursue what they do. You know, we all do. We look at each other and we say, "That's so strange, that thing that you're upset." He's with us on all the arguments. But what he couldn't understand was what it was in me that had made. And a lot of people have wondered this. God, what made you go so far with this stuff? That's kind of another discussion. I don't feel like I went so far so much as I got, you know, sucked in and sucked out to sea by this violent. By this war, by this violent climate we have. But anyway, he asked me a really good question. He said, did you have some great fear growing up? He said, mm-hmm. you know, like Batman was afraid of bats.
Right.
And I thought about it for a second, and I said, oh, yeah. And he said, what was it? And I said, being in trouble.
Hmm.
You know, many children grow up in a place where they're easily in trouble, and when they're in trouble, it's very bad. Very lucky children escape that.
Right.
No details necessary about that, but the in trouble feeling.
But
the more I unpack that, you know, that's really about the fact that you've expressed something. You've been yourself in a way. Now, there's legitimate being in trouble, you know, if
right.
you do something
mm-hmm.
really
mm-hmm.
stupid. But then there's being in trouble for what I would call thought crimes, which
right.
is more like what was going on in my childhood. Thought crimes, you know, you're
right.
in trouble for what you, for your natural thoughts or impulses or instincts, and
right.
and that to me is so offensive and wrong, you know. And
right.
I look at, for it in myself. Do I do that to people? I try really hard not to, especially now, never to make another person feel stupid or wrong or bad or sinful.
But how could that result in somebody being so non-conventional? Like, you would think that if you were worried about getting into trouble, that you would stay well within the bounds of acceptable discourse, which on HIV/AIDS means that you would promote the idea that HIV causes AIDS.
Right, well, then you would think Batman wouldn't dress like a bat and fly around, right? He's afraid of bats. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Batman was afraid of bats.
Right, right.
So he became a bat.
Okay. Okay, so you were afraid of getting into trouble, so
I believe unconsciously. I think, hate to say it, but I think I just found the biggest in trouble that was available in journalism
yes.
in the society when I entered the fray in 1986. Unconsciously. I've spoken to we both are friends with Tom DiFerdinando, who worked closely with Heal,
mm-hmm.
wonderful person, who also is a Reichian scholar, right? Wilhelm Reich.
Okay.
I have such a hard time saying his name. So Tom and I have discussed this. So Reich said, you know, yes, what I'm talking about right now could be called perhaps pathology, you know, the thing that you carry from childhood that makes you.
Right.
But it also carries your best essence, your best offering, the thing you were in fact supposed to do in the world. So Tom said, you know, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. In other words, don't think that you did all that just because you. And I don't think it's that useful to other people for me to psychoanalyze myself. But the reason I bring it up is because I think if we all looked at ourselves vis-a-vis this thing, thought back to childhood or perhaps later, at some point later in life, and asked ourselves, what are we really doing? There would be a really good part, and then there would be a part that we maybe want to, you know, take back to the shop and look at. Like, what is that thing right there?
Right.
Is there something in this where I'm not able to protect myself? I'm not able to. I mean, it's been really, really, really hard, really devastating. It's been beyond bruising, right? This is a very, very tough place to be. And so now, that's why.
Let's just give people some context. So, I mean, you started perhaps somewhat naively writing about AIDS in the late 1980s, right? And
yeah.
after you insisted on pursuing questions about the HIV/AIDS theory, about whether HIV caused AIDS, people went after you, and you were basically unable to practice journalism at that point. That's basically the, you know, one of the traumas you suffered, right?
I think there's a really helpful analogy. There were some writers in the '30s, '40s, 50s, mainly, let's say it really kicks in maybe 1950s
mm-hmm.
in intellectual circles, London, New York, places like that. There were some writers, like Kingsley Amis, a handful of writers, who actually went against the doctrines of you know, post-Bolshevik Western communism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the craze, the rage in the West at the time was to be communist, essentially sympathizers, because that was considered to be what was right and good after World War II and after Hitler, you know, the whole. So people, those who went against it were powerfully shamed and stigmatized and excluded. And I think the experience of HIV dissenters is very close to those people. In other words, it's about going against a certain hugely popular kind of big moral cloud idea at a time when it's already been defined what the moral cloud is and where we're going and why good people think like that. And then you kind of say, but hang on a minute, and you bring up some facts and you're, right. You're difficult. And the what's devastating and astounding is how factuality doesn't seem available, and whether it was for those writers back
well,
then, you know.
I think what I read to you a little earlier is an exact illustration of that, is that I put some facts on the table. They weren't even my words. They were words from sources that I'm not necessarily sympathetic to, such as the manufacturer of a drug I think is a poison. And I was just told basically the facts don't matter. You're crazy.
You see, this is what I'm getting at. This is what I've always been getting at. And I think the devastation is we weren't even allowed to compete, or the scientists, always kept trying to do is draw this circle around these, say, okay, you guys go in this circle, fight it out. I'm going to try to hold a space here, because that's what I consider to be journalism. Go in there and fight it out. And Thabo Mbeki did that in South Africa. You know,
right.
Come on, guys, come into this room and just have it out, because I don't know. I just work here, right?
Right.
But then the devastation is that something happens to the facts on a right, or it's not even the facts. It's the climate around the willingness to establish what a fact is, to agree on what a fact is. Because immediately what we go to is, who is a monster? Who is a moron? Who is a mass murderer? Who
right.
is, you know, instead of, is 2 plus 2 4, or is it 5?
Well, it's supposed to be dispassionate science, and yet people are tarred in these incredible terms, like people have called a lot of people, like Duisberg, for example, a mass murderer, because he had questions about AIDS drugs. So rather than addressing the science, you go immediately to the pejorative words and say we're not going to think or listen to him at all. And the facts, you're right, the facts have been decided, facts in ironic quotes, and we'll just make sure that the data matches facts, and if people start coming up with data that doesn't, we'll suppress them.
I've got, yeah, exactly. May I read you something from
yeah, sure.
Traumatic Narcissism, Relational Systems of Subjugation by Daniel Shaw?
Yeah.
This is in a chapter called Externalization of Shame. Rather than feel self-loathing and the helplessness of unrequited dependency needs, the traumatizing narcissist arranges for dependency and its accompanying shame to be kept external, assigned to belong only to others so as to protect himself from self-loathing and ultimately from decompensation, literally mortification or psychic death by shame. Contemptible, shameful dependency, weakness, badness must be continually demonstrated to be out there, not in here, in quotes. Bach, 1994, has observed this as well, stating that, quote, the overinflated narcissist can experience himself as cohesive and alive only at the expense of devitalizing his objects. To achieve this goal of devitalization, the traumatizing narcissist virtually colonizes others, using the other as a host, as it were, onto whom to project and control his unwanted and disavowed effects and self-states connected to dependency, especially the shameful sense of neediness and inferiority.
So in the context of AIDS,
That's what I would say. I'm sorry, but that's them. There are those in the dissident camp who do this as well, and I've railed against it.
Right.
That is essentially them. That's the AIDS research establishment, the activists.
I was going to talk about the victims. So in terms of the gay men, they were there. The intention was that they would become dependent on the drugs, and that they would believe, like these men that I was talking to, gay, HIV positive, AIDS drug users, they would believe so fervently that they're dependent on the drugs that if anybody comes along and says, you know, there's some problems with this cult that you're in, like what you're being told is not true, they would immediately reject that. And journalists were supposed to be dependent on the money that flowed into the journals, which often came from advertising. And therefore, if you essentially refused that money by criticizing some of the advertisers, you had to be destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that. What I take home from that quote, what it to me crystallizes, for me, that is absolutely my experience in one paragraph. My whole experience of, you know, why I wound up, pretty much incapacitated and fighting depression, later diagnosed as PTSD, it's because I was severely devitalized. That's such a good word, devitalized, abused, degraded, and shunned and told that I was, basically just worthless and dangerous and should be outside of journalism and outside of society. And that's a message we all got. I believe that it is a message that can end in a devitalization so powerful that you actually die, which I believe is what happened to Christine Maggiore.
Mm.
I think this stuff is very serious, and I think we as a kind of abjected, loose-knit, I guess we're a community, people who have opposed the HIV paradigm, though we're not, you know, certainly not a cult, because there are virtually no two people who think alike, or, you know, you could get to walk one city block in the same direction.
Well, yeah, I think that's an important point, is that when there's a dogma, the people who oppose the dogma don't necessarily adhere to an alternative dogma. They might be opposed to the whole concept of dogma, and they might want to look at all the different threads of information separately, and if they do that, then they'll never agree.
Right. Well, let's call it a tribe, right? It's some kind of tribe or kind of like dysfunctional family, something like that.
Tribe of outcasts?
Yeah. Well, but we're not, you see, the act of saying, hey, wait a minute, that makes no sense. Oh, I'm going to go interview Peter Duisberg, or that doesn't suggest outcast. You shouldn't be, you wind up as an outcast.
Right.
But outcast isn't what you wake up in the morning trying to be, right?
No.
But they say that. They say that we're just obsessed with defying authority and we have defiance disorder. You know, they've diagnosed me with every imaginable thing. It's really funny. Because if you're a woman and you do this stuff.
Right. I have HIV-related dementia, apparently, because I quote from scientific papers. So.
Well, a person expressing that, I feel like that's a psychotic statement, and I have felt like these people are actually coming apart at the seams mentally when they interact with us. It's like a total dissonance. There's something about their worldview and their psyche that just comes completely unspooled
That is a characteristic of a cult, right? Like if somebody is in a cult and they're living in this, what everybody outside the cult can clearly see is this irrational state where they have this domineering leader who's telling them incredible things. And yet, if you were to go individually to a cult member, unless that person was in the process of getting out, which is not that likely, they would defend to the death the statements of their dogmatic leader.
Even if
there was no rationality in that statement at all. I mean, I guess the famous one is Jim Jones, who took his followers to Central America and then they all commit suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, how could rational people do that? But we definitely see that within the AIDS cult. You see all this stuff written about side effects of the medications, cancer and muscle wasting and anemia and all of these different things. And it's all denied. It doesn't really exist.
Well, and as I've said, that cults have a deity, I guess almost without exception.
Mm-hmm.
The deity in AIDS, I've said this before, is a negative deity, and the negative deity is HIV.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I mean by negative deity? It's worship.
No, it's like the devil.
Negatively.
It's the devil, basically.
Right.
In Christianity.
But there's reverence in it. They don't just say it's bad and we want to crush it. It's kind of like a love-hate relationship they have with it. They don't want to ignore it or blow it off. Like, oh, all right, you can coexist and we'll see what happens. But they it's an obsessive relationship they have to that it, which may not even be an it, as you and I know. It's an extraordinary story. I won't back down on that. It is an extraordinary story that crushed my life. At least it was an extraordinary story. And I hope I'm around long enough to see how it ends, if it ever ends.
Let's take fundamentalist Christianity, for example, and let's say that there was evidence that God had slain Satan. So Satan's now out of the picture. Satan's dead. He's gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, would Christianity be the same in the terms of fundamental Christianity if everybody said, oh, you know, we finally defeated Satan. He's gone. For thousands of years we've been trying to do this. Now Satan's gone. Christianity would not be the same religion. It's not just the God, but it's also the anti-God is a critical component. And if you took HIV away from these people, if you were able to convince these people HIV didn't exist, then this whole infrastructure around them, this whole taking of drugs, which has become part of their life, this whole belief system is utterly destroyed.
Sacrament. Yeah.
So it's not so much the cult leaders, but it's the God that they're worshiping, and it's their belief in that God. And same probably with a cult. Like, if the cult is based on worshiping some god that the cult leader uses to manipulate people, if you lose a sense of belief in that god, then you're not in the cult anymore.
You're right. That's very interesting. I never thought about that before, how, yeah, Christianity is equal. Of course, I've thought of God and Satan, but the fact that Satan is just as important, if not more. But at least Christianity has a God that is positive and that is love and that is the good and that is life itself and wants the good. And that's what I look for in these people. Like, where is your good? Where is your hope? You cannot be serious that your hope, where you place your human heart hope in this time on earth, is it with Gilead Sciences and you've got some hideous toxic poison,
that's
49th drug to be approved. That's what you live for. That's what you're going to Melbourne now, and God forbid that terrible thing that happened. The plane blew up. You know, I'm digressing, but what I'm saying is the way I heard the news last night that at least three AIDS researchers, one of whom was very prominent, was on that plane that was shot down. And they were en route to the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne. And that just kind of lights up extra starkly, in a way, the insanity. I was just picturing all, and I've been to those conferences. I had to cover them in my years at Spin. Bob Guccione would make me go. And it was just the most devastating, crushing, surreal anti-life experience to be in those domes, and these people going all the way around the world. For what? For what? For what? Imagine if there's nothing at the epicenter of this whole thing. Imagine that.
Well, everybody. I think an important point is, in a cult where you only have a negative deity, like there are many people who are, you might, I'm using this ironically, might be in the cult of good health. So you have in this, it's not really a cult, but you have people who recognize that they're unhealthy, And then they become obsessed with eating better, exercising, drinking pure water, supplements, all this kind of stuff. And some people can take this to an extreme where that's the whole focus of their life. But they have a positive goal, which is, if I do these things, I will be in better health. I didn't used to be able to walk up the stairs. Now I can run up the stairs. That's a positive God, right? The God of perfect health, which, of course, we can never achieve, but we can try to emulate
that God
closer.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, if you completely get away from HIV, you have a medication that keeps your viral load at zero and your CD4 counts are 800 and all this kind of stuff, you're still never going to be in as good health as when you started this whole thing. Like, the end goal is that your health is, you know, getting closer to an average, not that great health person. But you will never, if you follow this path to the end, you will never be doing things that ordinary people can't do. You will never get better health, because it's all a negative thing. You're combating something negative, not trying to achieve something positive.
That's exactly right, because the positive, the concept of life itself, as it is given as a birthright, has already been eliminated here. So the birthright to live has been eliminated. You've been post facto killed off already in what I've called the first debt-based illness model, right? So you're marked HIV positive, you're dead, but you're in debt to your illness, right? Because it might take you 20 years to begin to pay off your illness debt, begin to become sick. And I believe at that point you become sick from the stress of waiting to get sick. But, you know, that's our whole discussion, chicken and egg and what makes people sick. And maybe we can do another show about that. But, I lost my train of thought. What was I saying?
You're caught in a strong current, and that current is going to drag you over the waterfall.
Oh, yes. Now I remember. You were saying about how there is no... In other words, this whole thing, what I was saying about the conference and the $400 billion juggernaut, all of them flying to Melbourne, all of that, you're right. At the summit, the peak of that mountain, what is there? It's not life. It's not healthy life. It's not good life. They would say it's, you know, it's the better deal than the surefire death that is HIV. They would say that. But really, it's a cult of fighting HIV. It's not, the goal is not life. The goal is not, let's get out of here.
Right.
And go live.
And if you offer them a way out, like let's talk about whether HIV is being purified or not. Let's talk and just talk about data. Let's talk about the evidence. Let's talk about Cox postulates, all that kind of stuff. Then they put up their defensive mechanism and start saying crazy things that you know, you or I can see are crazy. But if you're within the cult, seem perfectly legitimate, because the aim is to eliminate this person who's destabilizing the cult.
Right. Yeah, I started out not knowing what I was up against. I didn't know what or who they were, and I didn't know what or who I was. And often when you have a massive conflict or crisis or, you know, something that feels like the hardest thing you ever went through, I have found in life you do emerge with a reason, and it's like this really hard won lesson. My kind of chrysalis in all of this has been never to let an outside body, and this is a very ironic, of authority figures tell you you're okay or you're not okay. Tell you, you know, wake up in the morning and, okay, it's a good day if I don't get attacked. And I need to prove to you that I'm okay. No, I didn't say that. No, I didn't write that. No, I wasn't wrong. No, Harper's never said I was wrong. Etc. My cat loves me. You know, it's
well, it was true.
This groveling nonsense, and not nonsense, it was important, but I finally broke the back of it and said, I am now talking to you today. I am a person who is happy and free, free from that particular burden that I'd probably carried my whole life of, I can only be happy on a day when I'm not in trouble, when I'm not being condemned, when somebody said I'm okay.
Whereas these people who are taking drugs or within the cult, they have to go to a cult leader, like a doctor, to get their CD4 count, their viral load, to get all of these numbers. They're completely dependent upon that. Like, if they were cut off from the doctor and from this information which keeps them within the cult, information, in, again, in ironic quotes, they would be lost. And that's what keeps them there. The desire to go is perverse, the desire to go and find out their numbers. And if their CD4 counts have fallen from 600 to 500, there's devastation that this number causes within their mind. But they are within, that is totally within the control of the doctors, because they have no way to generate those numbers, whether they're meaningful or not. They have to go to a doctor within the AIDS cult in order to get those numbers that keep them within the cult.
You know what it is? It's a total internalization of the monetary system in living human beings. It's so demonic. It's so brilliant. Let's get everybody ticking, literally ticking, along with the stock market.
And in this, everything these people do generates money. When they go get their CD4 count, it generates money. When they're told that they need a newer, more expensive drug, it generates money. And all of these actions of cult generate money. But this brings
me
like to another.
It's like people, the cult's followers are people who swallowed numbers, who are mumbling numbers, who are numbers, right?
Right. But here's the question for you. You come from a conservative lineage. Your father was the conservative radio host Barry Farber, and you're obviously no fan of Stalin, and yet you've used terms like Stalinist or totalitarian to describe science that has arisen in the most pro-capitalist and anti-communist country in the world, the USA. So how did a totalitarian system arise, a totalitarian scientific system arise in this bastion of freedom?
What a great question. Wow. Okay, first I want to say I was raised by my mother in Sweden from the age of 11, and when we got to Sweden, I was immediately taken in by the Communist Youth Party and full-on indoctrinated. So my anti-communism, such as it is, came out of my own journey there, and I experienced an awakening, a betrayal. It was a canoe hike gone disastrous, and I saw my communist leaders fend for themselves. My best friend actually died. She was brought back to life. It's an incredible story, but it was how I lost my faith. And so I turned against communism around the same time. Everybody, young people in Europe at the time, you know, the punk wave was hitting, and we weren't on the left. We were, sounds so pretentious, but we were anarchists. So we were against statism in all forms, authoritarianism in all forms. That was the water I swam in, and this is what I guess people don't really get about me. I really was reintroduced to my father, who, you're right, he is a conservative. He's a what I call an anti-totalitarian conservative, which comes out of the tradition of writers like Peter Viereck, who influenced later Buckley, and it that kind of conservatism, post-war conservatism, was focused on the question of personal freedom, not personal freedom, I'm sorry, freedom, period.
Mm-hmm.
It was opposed to fascism and communism with equal passion,
mm-hmm.
right? So this question that I get about kind of people are asking, how are you not on the left? What I'm against is any form of repression and coercion, mm-hmm. totalitarianism, and communism obviously produced its own mega version of that, and fascism produced. But back to your excellent question, the United States, I think this happens a lot. It's like a kind of blind spot phenomenon that because we saw ourselves as this bastion of freedom, we're thinking in terms of certain kinds of freedom, right? This thing flies obvious signs of freedom. Can you leave the country? Can you speak your mind? This thing flies in under radar because what gets co-opted is the part of the human psyche, you know, that we've been discussing that gets hit by this paradigm. I'm going to die. Oh my God, I'm not free. I'm stained. I'm filthy. I'm not right. I'm going to spread an infectious deadly. All that stuff goes in where we didn't even think to be concerned about freedom.
Right.
So, again, it's a cult, right? So
that's how
it happens in the United States, because we're not immunized. I don't think it would have sprung in any country that had gone through any kind of totalitarianism, because I think they would say, get off my brain, you know? Whereas Americans didn't think to say, get off my brain. I did think to say that because I grew up in a quasi-socialist society, Sweden, and this is all we obsessed about as teenagers, you know? Who's on my brain? Who's trying to make me think a certain way? Does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, and maybe, like, the people in the United States who are trying to make you think tend to be the marketers. Like, I mean, that's one thing. Coming from Europe to America as a child, also, I saw much more marketing of products, Coca-Cola, 7-Up, whatever. But these people are much smoother than, you know, what I saw in terms of communist propaganda. Like, it's that you don't actually think it's propaganda. You look at an ad and it makes you smile.
David, is that they want your soul, right?
Yeah.
The communists wanted your soul, and these people want your soul. They don't just want you to go to the store and buy a pair of sneakers and then you can live your life. They want your soul. That's why I had such an allergic reaction to it.
Well, yes. I mean, what's ironic is it's all about money. And yet they've picked on people who really don't have the money to pay $10,000 or $20,000 a year for drugs or AIDS drugs that will kill them, and so they've created a system where they're also parasitizing the taxpayer, getting in America, which has, you know, as everybody knows, has basically a private healthcare system. AIDS seems to be an exception where if you have AIDS, your drugs are paid for, because after all, if they weren't paid for by the government, then you couldn't afford it, and the whole thing would fall apart. So there has to be kind of a communist, kind of a
government-supported... Exactly. It transcends the monetary profit issue, right? If you don't have $160, you can't buy those Nike sneakers. Nike doesn't care about you, right?
Right.
Here, it's like, again, they want your soul. So somehow, there's always been that revolving weird door, that vortex where those who can't pay for it, the government's going to pay for it, and Santa Claus is going to pay for it, because you have to be on the drugs for them to sleep well at night.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a company invents a shoe that goes over your nose, and people say, you know, why would I pay for this? So they persuade that the government should pay for them because people need them, and then they market for people to need them, and then people say, I need it, but I can't afford it.
Right.
So then it's like, oh, we have nose shoes for you, and since we were feeling so bad for you, we will give you them. And it's, oh, thank you.
You're so great.
Now you're inside the cult, because now you're dependent not only on the drugs for life, you think, but you're dependent on somebody to pay for it. And I don't know if you've seen this, but with a lot of HIV-positive people who are within the system, the sense of dependency on other people and the sense of what a conservative would call a sense of entitlement is enormous. Like, you must give me this. You must give me that. You must give me this. It's always, I deserve...
It is self-infantilization.
Mm-hmm.
I react very badly to it because I grew up, again, as a punk teenager in a in the world's most advanced welfare state.
Right.
And our issues were, okay, I grew up literally with a government that paid for my first pair of designer jeans, put all us girls on the pill at very young ages. You know, it was like a ski list. You just got on. Everything was just taken care of. So we were conditioned to rebel against that invasion of the space where, you know, let me risk something. Let me risk not getting the... Everybody got, when I say designer jeans, what I mean is they gave a clothing allowance to all children on two times a year. So everybody got their check from the government on the same day and went and bought their whatever clothes they were going to get. So that meant that there wasn't like one kid that could afford designer jeans. This is what they wanted to make sure. Though some kids weren't showing up in school with designer jeans and poor kids couldn't afford it. I know this probably sounds like a science fiction novel, right? It sounds incredible, but that was Sweden in the late 70s, early 80s. And all my friends always say, it's not like that anymore. That's not this. I know that, but that's another discussion. Anyway,
right.
what I'm getting at is that phenomenon of people being taken care of, quote unquote, coddled from cradle to grave, that's nanny state stuff. It's really familiar. I see through it. I don't see it as love.
Yeah. But I mean,
see it as quite menacing, and I see it as, you know, soft totalitarianism.
Right, but a pair of jeans.
Because you made people weak and sick to begin with. They're not weak and sick. People aren't weak and sick. You know, you introduce the helplessness, which you then rush in to answer because of your cult.
And that's what the purpose of the HIV test is when you're not allowed to tell somebody they're HIV positive over the phone. There are many other medical and scientific models in our society that to me seem just as irrational as HIV, and yet the majority of people defend them and attempt to throw out anybody who wants to rock the boat, whether we're talking about vaccines, psychiatric drugs, cancer, so many of these cults exist, and the response to critics is about the same.
Yeah. AIDS set is the original. I think none is more comprehensively diabolical than HIV. AIDS covers none covers more bases of, you know, the devastation of hope, the elimination of vital, organic, natural human life. I think the vaccine story is even worse in the sense of pure. Well, you have a choice in HIV/AIDS. You do have a choice. Children don't have a choice. The vaccine debacle, there's no choice. That one has me even more alarmed than the HIV catastrophe. But they have perfected this system of introducing destruction and death and taking no accountability, making lawsuits impossible, and then just focusing all efforts on the abuse and degradation of the critics. And we now know that there are formal, well-moneyed systems that have infiltrated the Internet that exist for the sole purpose of just bashing away at anybody who raises questions. So it's back to your original question, how could this happen? And this is the fusion of corporate marketing with fascist doctrine, I would say. That's how it could happen in America, because everybody knows we're not a capitalist society. We are a corporate fascist society, oligarchy.
No, I buy that. And, you know, the great thing is if you're making money out of this, is that if something goes wrong, so you give a vaccine and it causes autism, well, then you do research on drugs for autism. You don't go back to the cause and say, gee, you know, this seems like mercury in vaccines is causing problems, so we should question whether we should be putting mercury in vaccines, or maybe even question whether we need all these vaccines, or maybe question the whole science behind vaccines. No, you just say, oh, we've got this strange new disease called autism or multiple sclerosis or all of these diseases that have originated in modern history, and that nobody questions, you know, why is our modern advanced society generating all these new diseases, and why are people making so much money on it when we're actually getting sicker?
I think the good news, if we can end on a positive note, is things have gotten so bad that I think the quote unquote average American or average world, you know, citizen is now much more inclined to be, when we all began, it was considered, oh my God, how can you say that? Oh, the virus is deadly and people need the drugs. But now because people are cottoning on to the whole thing, that there, with all of the outcry against GMOs, against vaccines, against chemotherapy that kills, I feel like we're all coming together as a kind of symphony, and people are understanding there's organic life that works if you leave it alone and nourish it. And then there's all this scaremongering and profit. And now I think people can put our thing in the context of that and stop looking upon us as quite so crazy.
Yes. Well, hopefully after listening to this interview, nobody will think that we're crazy, and hopefully people will think more deeply about how these systems evolve. And so, Celia, I would just like to thank you so much for joining me for this hour. I found this conversation really stimulating, and it's always a pleasure to be talking to you. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, David. It was really a pleasure. You do great work.
Listen to both of our shows on PRN. And goodbye, everybody.